The first is Demetra Nightingale, who is a principal research associate and director of the Welfare and Training Research Program at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. For the past 20 years, she has conducted research on various issues related to employment, poverty, and social policy. In 1993, she also served as an expert analyst for the White House Interagency Work Group on Welfare Reform, where we worked together. She is the author of dozens of articles and reports, including a recent book with Robert Haverman of the UW Economics Department entitled The Work Alternative, Welfare Reform and Realities of the Job Market.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here today. Wisconsin is one of the states that I most enjoy coming to because over the past 20 years that I've been looking at welfare and poverty programs and employment programs, Wisconsin has usually been ahead of the curve on whatever that curve might be, and I think today is no exception. I think I am the kickoff speaker this morning to give you an overview of some issues, and I know the speakers who follow me will talk in more detail about some of the specific programs and interventions that they operate and some of the tax issues. What I'd like to do is give you an overview or just some highlights of some of the labor market trends that I think are particularly important for low-skilled workers and therefore the implications for welfare reform issues. And second, given that labor market context, what are some of the strategies that seem to work and some of the important issues that I think you should have in the forefront of your mind as you proceed with policy development? I've also passed out a second handout that I had as an afterthought after the briefing book, so I'm sorry it's not bound nicely with your others, but I will refer to this periodically. The good news is that the economy is continuing to boom. Even this morning, as I was leaving in the middle of the night to get here, the headlines for this morning are that the economy is still growing, the stock market seems to be rebounding, inflation's under control, unemployment is stable, and employment continues to grow. The big question that I hear, and many of you probably hear, is are there jobs for all these welfare recipients? Can the labor market absorb them? Well, the quick answer is yes. Employment continues to grow nationally, and again, everything I'm talking about is national. The numbers certainly are different in Wisconsin. I don't have them with me. But the patterns, I think, will be similar to the patterns I'm talking about. The employment growth continues at about 3 to 4% a year. Unemployment rate is fairly low nationwide at 5%, 4%, or even lower, as in some parts of Wisconsin. So the first answer, as several labor economists have identified, is yes, certainly, the labor market in the nation is very strong. We have, over the years since World War II, absorbed huge numbers of new workers into the labor market. The baby boom population, women entering the labor force, and we've done that without severe detriment to the economy as a whole. And we could probably do that again. The caution, of course, is that, as Rebecca Blank, who wrote a chapter in my recent book, says, yes, the labor market can absorb people as long as we don't expect all welfare recipients to all work at once. And so if we phase them in, and we know that there is cyclical employment going on in the labor market can probably handle a lot of the new workers. A second point, though, is that a lot of the jobs that are available may not necessarily be as good as what you hear. And on the very first chart in the handout on jobs in demand, these are the top 20 occupations that are projected to grow over the next decade based on the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics projections. And as you can see here, a lot of these are low-skilled or what might be considered low-skilled jobs, and a few are in the higher-skilled area. And by skilled, I would mean either technical training or education. So that really the pattern and the trend in the labor market that's important to remember is that the growth occupations are both at the high end where there are a lot of skills required, and what you don't hear a lot about, at the low end. So we do have projected growth at both ends of the labor market. It's in the middle is where we're not growing as rapidly. What that means, I think, is that we're increasingly in a situation where there are skill levels that have to be considered as you're looking at the opportunities in the labor market for welfare recipients. In the handout, you'll see some just brief summary statistics on the education and literacy of the general population compared to the AFDC population. And what's, I think, particularly important here is that about 45% of the welfare population do not have a high school diploma. It's a fairly low educated population. I know in Wisconsin it is higher. You have more with high school, which is good for in terms of labor market transition. Second is that even with a high school education, we do have a literacy deficiency among many of the welfare recipients. According to the National Adult Literacy Survey, about 37% of the welfare adults have the lowest level of literacy, meaning they would have difficulty even reading want ads and things like that. So that even with a high school education, we do have a low-skilled population. And the third point that I think is important to remember is the high incidence of learning disabilities. This is an area on which there is very little research, but that is done suggests that perhaps 40% of the welfare adults have some type of a learning disability. Now, those of you who are familiar with learning disabilities, and many people I find are today, is that we don't know how severe that disability is. It could be a minor disability. It could be borderline developmentally disabled. And so there's a big range in there. And it doesn't mean that people can't work. And in fact, increasingly there are strategies that are used that help individuals to accommodate their learning disabilities. Most people with learning disabilities are of high intelligence, and once they are instructed and they've had interventions to help them adapt to their learning disabilities, they in fact make excellent employees. So the fact that they're learning disabled should not necessarily mean that they are at a disadvantage in the labor market. While there are jobs for low-skilled workers, much of the research now also shows that there's a surplus of low-skilled workers. And this surplus means that in some labor market areas, there are many persons who are seeking each available job. And a well-publicized study in New York City, for example, by Catherine Newman, suggests that there may be as many as 14 people, job seekers, for every job opening in particular labor market areas. So yes, there are jobs, but the reality is that the demand for low-skilled jobs is not growing as rapidly as the supply of low-skilled workers. So there is a mismatch. Even though there are jobs, you often see people cycling in and out of those jobs because of the shift in the overall labor market. In addition, the low end of the labor market also tends to be somewhat less stable than at the high end and less likely to offer benefits, particularly health coverage. So the fact that a program or a welfare-to-work program would include health insurance is very critical, as well as child care, to help buffer the difficulties that low-skilled workers may have. And that while in some states as many as 40 or even 45% of the welfare recipients who go into jobs have health insurance, in other states it's as low as 15 or 20%. And I'm not sure where Wisconsin fits there, but it's an important issue to look at for families with children. There's also very high turnover in the low end of the labor market, referred to by labor economists as the secondary labor market. Often through no fault of the worker, the jobs may terminate, businesses may go out of business, firms may go out of business. It is, in fact, that turnover is, in fact, a characteristic of the secondary job market. So that programs that spend a very important time helping individuals to improve their so-called soft skills in terms of how they work and the presentation that they make in an interview and dealing with problems on the job can only go so far, because in the secondary labor market, often through no fault of their own, the jobs may end. Rebecca Blank also found that there is very little evidence that at the low end of the labor market that workers, especially men, but women as well, are very able to move up the job ladder, up the career ladder, simply by being employed. So work experience and employment alone, unlike 30 years ago, where it often, especially in manufacturing, was a route to upward mobility, there is no evidence that it has ever been a viable option for women, and it is a declining option for men. So unlike 30 years ago, just getting a job is not a guarantee or even a high probability that you'll be able to move up. Those factors, the surplus of low-wage, low-skilled workers, meaning you've got lots of competition for the low jobs that are out there, high turnover in the secondary labor market, and limited opportunities for upward mobility, I think are very important as we move from a system of welfare as an alternative or a supplement to work as the primary activity without the supplement. And I think that some of the efforts in Wisconsin and other states to include other services and other supplements, whether it's wage supplements, child care, health care, are critical to accommodate for that weakness. It means that there are jobs for the low-skilled workers, but that unemployment rates are generally higher as well. The next two charts are important. I just want to quickly mention them. First, the unemployment rates. And these are a few years old, but the pattern is the same, and they're for the nation, not Wisconsin, but I would say the pattern is the same, that the unemployment rate for persons with high school is twice as high as those with college degrees, and those without high school is almost five times as high, four to five times as high. And I think that's a general pattern that you see nationwide. And then the final chart depicts what is referred to as the skills gap. And because of the factors that I mentioned, the changes in the economy as we're moving from manufacturing, the surplus of low-skilled workers, we're also seeing declining real wages to work. And this is particularly true for men, but also true for women. And that in the left side of the chart, you can see that for men, the only ones who are seeing real increases in their earnings, this is after you adjust for inflation, over the past 20 years have been those with graduate degrees, six or more years of college. For women, the picture doesn't look quite as bad, but that's a little deceiving because women's wages are still quite a bit lower than men. And so the positive effect you see here only means that they're not losing ground as rapidly as men have lost ground. In fact, I think Rebecca Blank also identifies that for women, regardless of education level, their position in the labor market has been static over the past 20 years, so that young women today are no better off in the labor market than their mothers were 20 years ago. And that's an important distinction as well. What does all of this mean? So what works? A couple of points I want to just finish up with. First, we can, and we have all over the country and all over Wisconsin, moved low-skilled workers, women, welfare mothers into jobs. It's a low-cost strategy. You're doing it in Wisconsin. It's happening all over the country. A lot of the reason it's happening is that the economy is strong. So as long as the trend continues strong and there are plenty of jobs and plenty of cycling at the low end of the labor market, these programs are going to look pretty good. The caution, then, is that we will, I'm sure, I'm positive of this, at some point that we'll see the cycle shift and we will see unemployment rising again as we go into possibly a recession, and that we shouldn't kid ourselves to think that the strategies that work during a growth economy will also work during a recession. To retain employment, whether it's during a recession or good times, we need more investment, or we need some investment other than just immediate job entry, work first strategies. We need more investment in services like child care, and we need support for the job and the family, so that individuals at the low end, and women especially, often lose their jobs or stop working because of problems that to middle-class America seem easily solved. Problems with their children, problems with housing, difficulty with transportation, not getting along at work, things that through networking and through kinship support or friends and family support we're able to overcome. And we'll hear later about some strategies for helping women to develop those skills, but we need to also understand we have to invest as a society in those skills. And third, there's a need, a very serious need, for labor market information and knowledge to help individuals, particularly women, make transitions between jobs. So if, in fact, the labor market that they are qualified to go into is low-skilled, low-wage, high turnover, and little upward mobility potential, we need to think in the long run about strategies that will enable individuals to obtain knowledge and information about job opportunities, about ways to combine employment with education and skills development in the long run, whether that's part-time employment and community college work at night, again, raising further issues about child care. But we know that the only route toward upward mobility is the continued acquisition of skills. Those, again, are not real high-cost approaches, but we need to incorporate them in and not just think that moving people into the labor market is the end of the story. There are many strategies of intervention in education, employment, and training, and they're listed on page 5 in your briefing book, and I won't go into all of them. And many of these have been evaluated. Some have not, and the evaluations are of different quality and different program geographic areas. But on page 10 to 12, you'll see a summary of what some of the research has shown. And in a statement, most of the research evidence to date has not shown great impact overall. The net impacts, meaning what would have happened without the programs, has been modest, although usually positive. The 20 years of the research shows that employment rates can be increased some, especially if the economy is good, and that wages can rise a little bit. But just like you would conclusion you would draw from the beginning part of my statements about the labor market, the evaluation research also confirms that so far the interventions for the past 30 years and currently have done little to move people out of poverty. What I think that means for where we go from here is that I don't think we any longer should be thinking about welfare to work strategies, although that's important. I think a much bigger issue is dealing with low-wage working poor, strategies to help working families, both supporting their family roles and helping them in the workplace, and most importantly, helping to develop some lifelong learning and skills development approaches. Without welfare to fall back on, some of the evidence from the research will probably be higher, but the problems will be also more severe because there will be fewer alternatives during the downtimes in the economy. And finally, the use of subsidies, and this is, again, a big issue, and I think other speakers will talk about it. I would say that we need to be very careful about how we subsidize employers to hire welfare recipients. We need to maximize the efficiency, which means you want to target your investment, your tax investment, in the best possible way. Those half of the population, or maybe a little less in Wisconsin, or more in Wisconsin, who already have a high school education, are probably the most likely to get a job in the labor market currently without a subsidy to the employer. So that if you are subsidizing those employers, policymakers need to understand that some of it is sort of substituting, and it really is a windfall to the employers. That may be okay, but you need to understand it. Others, those without high school, I think are the ones we should be targeting our tax credits on and our subsidy programs, whether it's through on-the-job training contracts, tryout employment, or temporary employment followed by regular employment, supported work experience with ongoing support and graduated increases in work responsibilities. And I want to just end with a plug for what Bob Haberman always calls for, is rather than hiring tax credits, where employers get tax credits for hiring certain individuals, we might do better with a reformatted new hire tax credit, where individual employers would get a tax credit for the net increase in employment that they create, rather than hiring people that they would have hired anyway.
Do we have any, we have 5 minutes for questions. Any questions? Comment was, there was some amazement at the figure of 40% of the population with reading or learning disabilities or developmental disability issues. And the person pointed out that NIH has some studies on by Reed Lyons, is that the name, that has some methodologically sound, longitudinally peer-reviewed studies that show at NICHG that show some promising results.
Right. And that 40% was learning disabilities, not just developmental disabilities. And it's based on some estimates that I did several years ago where the incidence of learning disabilities in the general population is about 10%. And most of that estimate is based on studies of children, but children grow up to be adults with learning disabilities. But the incidence is much higher for the poverty population because of both environmental, prenatal, and childhood health problems that have exacerbated some of the disabilities that we find. But your point is well taken.
Okay, the question is, can Demetra expand on the research on supported work programs?
Yes, because it's one of my favorites. Of all of the research that's been done in the employment and training area, the most positive net impacts have been for supported work experience. It is, though, one of the more expensive ones, so it should be used frugally. What the supported work concept means is that for some period of pre-employment or pre-job assignment, individuals receive 6 to 9, it depends on the program, months of counseling, job preparation, orientation to work, not necessarily skills training, although some programs incorporate skills training. After that, they're assigned with an employer who has already been oriented toward the program and has agreed to work with these people. And over time, there is increased responsibility on the job, and rather than starting someone off as a regular employee with full responsibilities, they may start off with limited hours combined with ongoing peer support and group counseling and possibly job training. And then over a 9-month period, the amount of increased responsibility on the job increases, and the peer support continues for as long as they can afford to do that. The net impacts have been the highest wherever it has been evaluated. It is especially appropriate for women and welfare recipients, I think because of the support that goes along with it and because it's a gradual attachment to the labor force. Costs about possibly between $9,000 and $12,000 a year per person, so it is a little high. Some states have used the diversion of the grant to fund the subsidies both to employers and to pay for some of the program operations.
Thanks a lot.